Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. The Nazi Holocaust took the lives of more than 12 million men, women, and children. Many of them were Jews living in Poland and other parts of Eastern Europe during the 1930s and 40s. Today, we're looking back at that period. Coming up, we'll hear from a local author whose mother's experience during the Holocaust inspired a new novel. Joining us now is Ohio State University history professor Robin Judd, who specializes in Jewish and European history. Welcome to the show.
Thank you so much, Anne, for having me here.
This focus on Poland today, it's righteous. Over 3 million people died during the Holocaust from Poland. Just about 50 or 70,000 people, Jews, I should say, were left after the war. Shocking.
Yeah, it is shocking. And a very small percentage of Polish Jewry survived the war.
Why is that? What do we know about what happened there that had such an impact like that?
There are probably a number of variables that led to the very high deportation rate and then the very high murder rate of Polish Jews. And we need to remember that those are two very separate variables, right? One thing that we look at is, what was the success rate of deportations? How many Jews were deported from one place to another? And then we also look at the number of Jews murdered by the Nazis and their collaborators. The death camps were all located in Poland, and one of probably the largest reasons as to why we see such a large murder rate in Poland is because of the death camps located there.
It was easy to move people to them.
Absolutely. I mean, the Nazis had a huge, huge setup of deportations across Europe, across Nazi-occupied Europe, but the death camps were located solely in Poland.
Well, Poland was the first country they invaded, right? Or not?
It depends on how we understand invasion. Okay. The Nazis invade Poland in 1939, and that's what begins the war. In 1938, we have the Anschluss, the annexation of Austria, okay. And we also have the movement into the Sudetenland. That's also in 1938. In the beginning of 1939, we have Nazi movement into Slovakia. It's in 1939 that the war officially begins when the Nazis invade Poland.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. We're looking back on the impact on Poland during World War II, the Nazi invasion, the Russian invasion, the Nazis. It was back and forth, back and forth. Robin Judd is who I'm talking to right now. She's a history professor at Ohio State University. She specializes in Jewish and European history. Coming up, we're going to hear from Linda Cass. Her new book is entitled Tasa's Song, and it is inspired by her mother's early life in Eastern Poland during World War II. So, stay tuned for that. If you have a question or a comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. Poland was a country, it had been invaded before. This wasn't a new dynamic for Poland.
Right. And I mean, it's not a new dynamic for much of Europe, mm-hmm. of course, but absolutely in 1939, the Nazis invade Poland from one side, and the Russians invade Poland from the other. And in fact, one of the things that is always so confusing with my students when we teach the history of the Holocaust is that we constantly have to be looking at the map, because the Nazis, when they invade Poland and they extend part of the Nazi Reich into Poland, the Soviets move into the other side of Poland.
And the Germans took the western.
Right. Right. So the Germans are going to take the westernmost part of Poland because that's, of course, next to Germany. The Soviets are going to be taking the easternmost part of Poland. That's next to the Soviet Union. And then there's that sort of middle area as well.
How do the two invasionary forces compare and contrast from the Polish point of view?
Well, that's a great question and one that is highly contested, okay. Certainly, and has much to do with how people remember their particular experiences, what their relationships were with their occupiers. The Nazis were horrifically cruel to the Poles. I mean, they imagined the Poles and the Slavs as very low on their sort of racial hierarchy that they envisioned. The Soviets were not particularly kind as occupiers either. And so certainly there was a very strained relationship between the Poles and their Soviet occupiers. And that's going to play out as a very important part of the narrative when the Nazis then move into what had been Soviet-occupied Poland.
And as far as Poland itself, what was going on in Poland at the time? Where was it? How did it rank just in the world in terms of its arts, its culture, its education, that kind of a thing? What was interrupted?
Well, I mean, Poland was a thriving European country in the interwar period. And the Nazis' invasion of Poland from the westernmost part of Poland and the Soviet invasion of Poland from the easternmost part of Poland totally disrupts everyday life in Poland. And it's a very, very rapid invasion, right? The invasion begins at the beginning of September of 1939. And by the end of September of 1939, Poland is in shambles.
Now, deportations were a big part of that. How many people got out?
Well,
deported to where, I guess, is the other question. Yeah.
Right. I mean, I think one thing that we need to remember is that in September of 1939, when the Nazis and the Soviets invade, they are not at this point deporting people to death camps. The death camps themselves don't begin murdering their victims until 1941. In 1939, they will slowly begin to deport individuals to labor camps and also to ghettos. But that doesn't take place immediately at the moment of invasion. At the moment of invasion, there's massive movement. And why is there massive movement? Because there are armies coming in, intruding into these cities and towns. And so there are people begin to flee, right? It's wartime, and people leave their homes and they run. And sometimes they are able to move to another town or to another village or to another city, perhaps where they have relatives or friends. And sometimes they are unable to move because already that advancing army has come in and conquered the territory.
Was there much of an underground?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, there was a very large, extensive underground throughout Poland that's going to become a very important part of the story of the Second World War.
Mm-hmm. At the end?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, actually throughout, right?
Yeah.
I mean, and certainly the underground is going to have many different roles. There are many different parts of the underground. There are non-Jewish Poles who are part of the underground. There are Jewish Poles who are part of the underground. It's not one homogenous movement.
Why did the Nazis decide to build and put their death camps in Poland?
That is a wonderful question, and a question that is often much debated. Some of it has to do with the topographic landscape. Some of it has to do with possibly the willingness of the Polish population, perhaps. Some of it has to do with the fact that the Nazis were unwilling to build death camps in Germany itself. And again, death camps as being camps that were specifically for the purpose of murdering the mm-hmm. victims. And so there are many, many different reasons as to why. Some of it has to do with the materials that would be easily accessible, the railways. So there are many reasons as to why it would have been there.
And what kind of network of sympathizers for the targeted people, including obviously millions of Jewish people, what was the network of sympathizers for them in Poland?
Those individuals who sympathized with the victims?
Yes.
So certainly there are always individuals who are sympathizers with the victims, right? And those are the important sort of exceptional stories that we are inspired by.
Right.
However, in Poland, there were also a significant size population that was willing to allow to at least be bystanders, to allow for what was to happen around them. And part of that, again, has to do with the camouflage of wartime.
Were Jewish people in Poland before the war, were they accepted into society? They were, well, you know, they were successful.
Some of them were, and
yeah.
some of them were not, right?
Well,
I mean, the Jews were not a homogenous population in Poland. They're not homogenous anywhere. But certainly they are a mixed population. Some of them are very observant. Some of them are not. Some of them are very wealthy. Some of them are not.
Were they really segregated by neighborhoods?
They were certainly more integrated in some of the cities where they lived. And there were other places where they would have been living with other Jews and sort of not at all integrated into their populations.
Yeah. As far as what happened when they started to move them to ghettos, did some people try to avoid that right away?
Certainly, there are some individuals who see the ghettos as a harbinger of things to come, and begin to plan their escape, to find ways to avoid going into the ghettos, to hide underground. For others, the ghettos seem daunting, absolutely, terrifying, absolutely. but didn't see themselves as having any other choice. And so they go into the ghettos, or perhaps they already lived in the ghettos. Yeah. I mean, very often the Nazis chose or designated the ghettos as the area where Jews were already living. So right. somebody might actually remain in his or her apartment and perhaps maybe live with a family member that had come in from another city, and that was the ghetto.
How much did people in Poland know about what was happening at the death camps where they were murdering Jews?
Well, did they
know that's what was happening?
The murders begin in 1941.
Right.
And certainly information begins to leak to the ghettos in a variety of different ways. The underground that you asked about before, mm-hmm. that's one of the things that they do, right, is to spread information. Mm-hmm. There are some individuals who believed what they heard. There were some individuals for whom it was just unfathomable. And there were some individuals who never get that information.
And as far as, in the book Tasa's Song, the main character, the protagonist in the book, she's living with a non-Jewish family, or the woman, the head of a family is a woman. And I was wondering what happened to people. Am I right?
No. You mean who she's boarding with?
When she was boarding with, yeah.
She was Jewish.
She was Jewish.
She
okay.
was Jewish. Okay. Rothstein.
All right.
Rothstein.
All right. So what? How did people talk to each other when the invasion, whether it was the Russians or whether it was the Nazis? How did they talk to each other about what they were going to do? How did they make plans and safeguard themselves? You know, how did you make plans to get away or do whatever you were going to do without anyone finding out? In fact, the protagonist in that book, she was in school, so she was on a list somewhere.
Right, absolutely. I mean, the protagonist in Tasa's Song, she goes with her family, right, to hide underground. That's an arrangement that her father has made with one of his sort of former workers that he had worked quite closely with. And that is a narrative that we often see emerging, right?
Okay.
That a family reaching out to another family. Perhaps it's a nanny going to the parents and saying, I will take your child. Perhaps it's a former school teacher who will go to a family and say, you know, I've heard about what's happening and I will help hide you. In some cases, it's orchestrated by the underground in a more thoughtful, strategic way where there are sort of cells and networks. We don't see one uniform story of hiding. We see multiple stories of hiding. And hiding is a very hard thing to study because of exactly the question that you ask, which is we don't have, you know, extensive written records of how they communicated
because
they could not have left those sorts of records. And when, in fact, you know, often we see resistance efforts getting too big, that's when they would get revealed, right? Because, you know, once too many people know about something,
right.
then it's easy for somebody else to find out.
We're talking about Poland during World War II. My guest is Robin Judd. She's a history professor at Ohio State, where she specializes in Jewish and European history. Coming up, we're going to hear from the author of a new book, a novel, the script of which was taken from that era. The name of the book is called Tasa's Song. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. You're just hearing from a cut from Tasa's Song. It's composed by violinist Charles Weatherby and performed by the Carpe Diem String Quartet. The melody is inspired by a new novel about a Polish woman who survived the Holocaust in an underground bunker. We're talking about the Holocaust today with a focus on Poland. Still with us is OSU history professor Robin Judd. And joining us now is Linda Kass, author of Tasa's Song. Welcome to the show, Linda.
Thank you, Anne. Thanks for having me.
It's inspired by the life of your mother. You say there's big touch points that are not fact. But tell us about what did happen to your mother.
Well, And when I was a young child, my mother told me all kinds of stories about her village. She lived in a small village, and it was called Poid Kamen in eastern Poland. And she told me about the countryside. She had an extended family that all lived close together in this small village. She did board in a town because back then, you know, you went up through sixth level in these little villages. And if you wanted to have a further education, your family, if they could support you, they sent you to another town to go to a private gymnasium. And so she did have those experiences. She talked to me about then war later when I was older and oppression and whatnot. So I had these major points in her life in my mind for many, many years.
There have to be, Robin Judd, so many stories.
Yeah, there are.
So many. I mean, a million more to tell. 7 million more to tell.
There are many, many, many stories. And one of the things that I tell my students, and it's I say this sort of with even more mixed emotion, given that I'm sitting next to Linda here right now, is that it's in our generation, our students' generation, that they will hear that the very last Holocaust survivor has passed away. And it's really, for us, there's really an amazing obligation to have that opportunity to hear from survivors. And what Linda has done by, you know, learning her family story, sharing it with the family, and then writing a novel based on her mother's story is really an incredible gift to all of us.
Did you feel this pressure to get to it?
No. What happened, really, I'm a journalist by background, mm-hmm. and so in my 20s, I interviewed both my parents. My father's from Vienna, actually, and I interviewed them, and then I put those facts in a drawer for many decades, actually. And in the fall of 2011, my husband and I went to visit our daughter in Berlin. She was studying abroad, and we took a side trip to Poland, and that's what triggered
That was your first visit there?
It was my first visit there. And so coming back, I just couldn't keep the story out of my mind. And, you know, when our parents get older, and I had these pieces of information, and I just thought it was a story that I really wanted to get out there.
The story, the arc of the story is about a young violin prodigy, Tasa. She starts out very young in the story, and we watch her grow up during the war. And she falls in love and has relationships that way. That isn't what your mom's story was necessarily.
No. My mother did have a violin. I've never seen the violin. I'd never seen the violin. And, you know, I know she had the violin on the boat back from Europe to America. Mm-hmm. But I just didn't – she was not a violin prodigy. I just felt that there needed to be something that this this character could really have to help her survive, since survival really is the main theme in a way in this book. And the main question I wanted to answer as I was writing this book is, how does someone survive this kind of experience? And then, you know, obviously she falls in love, and that is not something that was part of my mother's history that she told me, mm-hmm. certainly.
Well, tell me then why you chose to tell the story partly in music and very explicitly. It's like another character in the story as I read it. You include a playlist and musical references at the back of the book. And so I was wondering how and why you used it that way.
I feel music is very healing. And, you know, it just seemed that would be a way that this character could get through all the experiences that she did without listing all of them. I don't want to spoil all that, mm-hmm. you know, happens in this novel. But it just seemed that this would be her way of handling the emotional, the spiritual survival that was necessary in her life.
The fact that she kept your mother, in reality, did keep the violin and had it with her when she left, that's something. And I'm wondering, Robin Judd, you know, are there artifacts like that? Is that unusual when you've left so much behind? Is something like that take on that much more meaning?
Absolutely. If you were lucky enough to be able to hold on to one of these artifacts, then that had tremendous meaning. There's an amazing musician, picking up on Linda's theme of music, by the name of Flora Jagoda, who lives in the Washington, D.C. area. She's an incredible Ladino folk singer. And she had her accordion with her, a small accordion. And when I interviewed her a number of years ago, one of the very first things that she did was to show me the accordion that she had with her during the war and that she brought with her to the United States. So certainly these things had tremendous meaning.
Treasured meaning. And when your mom talked about what went on during the war, when did she start to tell you about the bad, bad stuff?
You know, I can't remember exactly when, Ann, mm-hmm. but I think by the time I went to high school, I met a friend. You know, here I lived in the Midwest, and my parents had accents, and I didn't really know anyone who had parents with accents until I got to high school. I met a dear friend whose parents had obviously numbers on their arms. And, you know, I go home, talk to my mother. What, you know, I realized that her survival was exceptional, yeah. that she didn't experience the concentration camp. So she had a different experience. And right. that's how we learned. We talked about her hiding underground and how she got through with this family, this wonderful family who risked their lives, really, to save them.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. We're talking about Poland during World War II, invaded it from the west by the Germans, invaded by the east from the Russians, and in between roughly 3.3 million Jewish Polish residents, citizens, stuck between all of that. Millions, of course, most were lost during World War II and from the Holocaust, murdered during the Holocaust, left behind as many, they estimate between 50 and 70,000 Polish Jews survived World War II. Right now I'm talking with Linda Cass. She is author of a new book entitled Tasa's Song. It's very much inspired by her mother's early life in Eastern Poland during World War II. Also with us, OSU history professor Robin Judd. She specializes in Jewish and European history. If you have a question or comment, you can give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. Linda, are you a musician?
I do not play the violin, Ann, but I can read music, and I took piano, classical piano, when I was a young girl. Uh-huh. And my father, I mentioned, was from Vienna.
Yeah.
So classical music has been something that has been part of my life growing up.
It felt like it from reading the book that you were very fluent in the language of music.
Well, and I spent a long time with the Columbus Symphony Orchestra, serving that organization for many years. Mm-hmm. And you know, the music sort of just was inside me. And it was just a thrill to bring it out into this novel.
How did you choose what music would be a part of the novel?
Sometimes it was an accident. Sometimes I was just listening a lot to different kinds of music. And I also have friends who are musicians. And I just tried to find the exact, just like with any of the historic facts in this book, it required some research. And sometimes I would just land on a piece that just perfectly helped express the emotion of the scene.
But you first had to, this is a book, and you had to describe the emotion of the music in the book through yes. the eyes or the ears of Tasa.
Yes, yes. So I had to inhabit this character and listen to the music very carefully and try to see how she would interpret it, how it would affect her. And that's how I would write it into the scene.
You know, Robin Judd, I was watching The Pianist last night about a real, very famous Polish musician who was helped a lot through the war times in Poland by an artist community, sort of an underground artist community that helped each other try to save each other. Were there thematic things like that? Was that typical?
Well, I think what's typical is that community, that individuals within certain communities would help one another.
Yeah.
Right. And one sort of natural kind of community would be a certain kinds of artist community. And certainly we see that. I mean, we see that with writers, we see that with painters, that often there are relationships that get built among these individuals who then are willing to reach out and help one another. certainly we also see the other side of that story, which is in some of those communities, there isn't the hand that's extended to help the other.
Right, right. So your mother, Linda Cass, just died, mm-hmm. 93 years old, just a couple weeks ago on Holocaust Remembrance Day, as a matter of fact. She read the book?
I read to her. She had lost a lot of her hearing, and her sight wasn't great either. But when I was writing the first draft, I read to her. I think it's now chapters 2, 3, and 4, but they were the first three chapters originally, my mm-hmm. first draft. And I wrote this to be a novel, so it was very clear. But so I read it to her, and she loved it. And then she said, "But Tasa, I'm not Tasa." And I said, "Right, great. You are not supposed to be Tasa." And so, you know, she enjoyed it. My father was a real fan. I mean, he read the entire first draft, and then he read the entire book when it was completely finished. Uh-huh. And he, of course, knew my mother's, you know, history quite well. And they were very supportive.
Yeah. And was it authentic to them?
Well, my dad gave me the biggest compliment, actually. I don't know if he knows this, but he said to me after he read the first draft that he could not believe how I hadn't lived during that time period, and yet it felt like it was then. That's what he said. And that was just great when I heard him say that.
Well, there was a lot of attention to detail, absolutely. I mean, you just felt, you know, you really felt like you were there. You knew what people wore. You knew what they ate. You knew what they listened to and that kind of a thing. And then there was an episode in the book that had to do with the Russian occupiers and how these young teenagers sort of responded to them. And I was wondering, Robin Judd, just about how did young people back in those days, what do we know about how they responded to the Russians in Eastern Europe, in Eastern Poland
at
that time?
You mean at the end? I don't want to give anything away.
No, but at the beginning.
Right. So certainly, I mean, one of the things that's amazing about the novel, and Linda and I have spoken about this, is that her mother did survive.
Yeah.
And that this extended family, you know, in the novel, that they survive in hiding. And it's these teens, right, who are experiencing the occupying Russians in the beginning of the novel, and then without giving too much away, but we know what happens in 1945, right? The liberating Russians at the end of the novel. And certainly the way in which teens responded to and experienced those Russians were very different, right? Very different in the beginning when they're the occupiers and very different at the end when they're the liberators.
Yeah. I mean, but they're teens.
But they're teens.
Yeah.
Absolutely. And that's, you know, that's one of the things that I loved about the novel, is that it's true to the sort of historic moment in many ways, but it's also true to adolescence, right? I mean, there are these two, actually several adolescents in the novel, and they respond like adolescents, right? And certainly when they're engaging with the Russian occupiers in the beginning of the novel, they're responding as Poles, but also as teenagers.
Right.
Well, you know, this scene we're talking about, I just felt that these are 16. It was a point where she's 16. She's 16. There are lots of terrible things are going on. They're seeing him in their school. And there's so much tension that I'm just thinking, you know, when I was 16, you have to release that tension somehow. And you got to get go after the bad guys. Mm-hmm. And so there's interesting way that they kind of get back at the soldiers. Mm-hmm. In my imagination.
Prankster.
Sure.
Yeah. And the schools, it's very interesting. We often think of the conqueror changing history. You know, whoever wins writes the history, right? And the Soviets immediately did that when they occupied Poland at the beginning.
Absolutely. They insert themselves into the educational system. And Linda captures that very nicely in the novel,
yeah,
where in some cases the teachers get replaced. In some cases the teachers remain, but the narrative gets replaced.
They change what they're teaching.
Absolutely.
And is there a lot of documentation of that? Are there books? I mean, is there evidence of that? Or is it oral histories at that point?
Well, we certainly have the oral narratives, yeah. that the recollections, but we also do have some recollections of teachers. We have historians who have studied this phenomenon. So we do know about the ways in which education gets used, gets manipulated by different forces.
And at what point was there ever a complete breakdown of the system in Poland, and that the schools fell apart, government fell apart?
It depends on how – well, those are two different questions,
good question,
right? Right.
Yeah.
No, they're great questions, and they're different questions. Certainly, schools get disrupted in all kinds of ways because it's wartime, mm-hmm. right? And so it really depends on place and time as to what happens to the school system. With occupation, the former Polish government gets dismantled. And in fact, Poland itself gets divided in all different kinds of ways throughout the war as the war is taking place.
Yeah. And so, you know, one thing that becomes very distinctive in this particular novel and in my mother's story is that she lived in that eastern swath of Poland. And in that eastern swath of Poland, 17 days after Germany invaded Poland, there was a secret pact between Hitler and Stalin, and that was how the Soviets then took control over that eastern swath. So her village, where she went to school, those towns, that part of Poland, that's where the Soviets then were in control for those 2 years until the Germans attacked.
And that was the case for your mother?
That was the case for my mother, and that was what was so also different. You know, she lived in that part of eastern Poland where that happened, where she was under the two different occupiers.
Again, going back to Robin Judd's assertion that you really need a map.
Mm-hmm.
And you really need to be able to see what you're talking about.
And that's why I actually
do
have three maps in there, because I actually had to map this out as I was writing it. I had to visually see these things. So I was making drawings, and then those drawings I gave to a cartographer.
Right. I referred to them several times myself when I was reading the book. It was interesting and helpful to know that. And yeah, I mean, you need a map to tell the story. We're talking about Poland during World War II. My guest is Robin Judd. She's a history professor at Ohio State University. She specializes in Jewish and European history. My other guest is Linda Cass. She's author of a new book. It's a novel entitled Tasa's Song. It's very much inspired by her mother's early life in Eastern Poland during World War II. If you have a question or comment, you can give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. You just heard a bit from Violin Concerto No. 9 in D minor, composed by Louis Spohr, performed by Philip Agnese on violin and Rusudan Alavish on piano. Author Linda Cass used references to music throughout her novel, Tasa's Song. It's a story inspired by the experiences of her mother as a young Jewish woman trying to survive in occupied Poland during World War II. We're talking about the Holocaust today with focus on Poland. Still with us as well is OSU history professor Robin Judd. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513. So, Linda Cass, the song we just heard coincides with the chapter entitled A Country Apart. What's the significance of that? Is this a turning point in the novel?
Well, and what occurred at this point, March 1944, the area where the family was living in the bunker, suddenly they could see that the Russians were taking hold and winning against the Germans. So there was, it was becoming safe. And she actually played this piece going into the Gnip home. The Gnips were the family that
saved.
Built the bunker and saved this family. And so she played this piece, and it was really a point at which she was they were there, and part of the her father and Donik, the other main character, they went back to her village because it seemed that it was liberated at that point by the Soviets, which is, it's an interesting thought. I remember my mom telling me that they were liberated in the spring or March of 44, and when I went back and looked at my typewritten notes from many decades earlier, I thought she made a mistake, because how could that be? The war was over in 1945. Mm-hmm. But really, it was these towns and villages and parts of the country were liberated piece by piece as the Germans were pushed farther and farther west.
Was there fear, Robin Judd, that the Germans would push back? I mean, people were afraid to come out of those bunkers. The people who were lucky enough to have survived had not gone to the concentration camps. I think it would be so frightening to reveal yourself.
Absolutely. And in fact, in the novel, we have that dilemma where within this family that's hiding, there are some who are really concerned about leaving the safe space and worried that, in fact, the Germans will return. Liberation takes place very slowly. There's movement back and forth.
Yeah.
And even when liberation takes place as late as 1945, there are individuals who, when the war ends, are very worried about revealing who they are because they've been hiding for so long that they can't quite believe that the war is over. So certainly that was a very genuine, very natural response.
Yeah. Linda Cass, did your mother in real life, did they worry about revealing themselves?
Well, when they were in the bunker, they were, she was protected until there was a point at which there were some Germans above the bunker, and she was extremely fearful during that short period of time that they would be found. But they really stayed there, and really the family, my understanding was this savior of theirs would let them know when it was safe to come out, because there was such fluidity about what was going on above.
Robin, tell us about your current research. What do you study about this period of time now?
Well, I now have moved towards liberation.
Okay.
I'm looking at women's lives that are somewhat different than Linda's mother, namely Jewish women who survive the war and then marry British, American, and Canadian soldiers. And then after their marriage, come to the United States, to Britain, or to Canada.
And are there parallels here with what happened in Tassassong?
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. One of the really driving questions that I had when I started my research was about gender and the way in which gender sort of helps us frame the story, how we use it as a prism to tell the story, sort of questions about coming of age. That was another one of the questions that I asked that I think is really very much part of the story.
I mean,
Taza comes of age throughout this novel. And in my work, I look at women who also come of age during the war and then marry men, some of whom are their liberators, and become adults sort of almost overnight. And how they make lives for themselves is what interests me.
And what kind of documentation are you finding in your research? Is it letters? What do you find that tells that story?
The joy of being a cultural historian is that I use all kinds of documentation. So I've done interviews.
Obviously, oral histories are very important.
Absolutely. I've done oral interviews of the women and the men, and sometimes also of their children.
Mm-hmm.
I study the chaplains' reports because very often the people who marry them are chaplains. I look at letters home from soldiers. I look at letters that these women write perhaps to the families of the men that they marry. I look at governmental reports. I look at NGOs who get involved, the non-governmental organizations get involved. So there's all kinds of documentation. It's just spread out internationally. So I've traveled to Belgium, to France, to Germany, to Israel, looking for materials to write this book.
Linda Cass, what kind of research did you do? Same?
Similar, yes. Okay. There are many, many, obviously, books out, both novels and history books. There have been many, many films. And just because I am a first-generation American, having parents who both survived the Holocaust, I've always been very interested my whole life and have absorbed over many decades really any kind of material that has come out. I interviewed people. I certainly interviewed my parents mm-hmm. and my mother for this story. And, talked also to musicians. And I did, all kinds of other research to ensure the verisimilitude, really, mm-hmm. of this period in terms of everything that's concrete in this book. I mean, whether it's the coins that they use, the zloty, or the, or what they grew in the lands, mm-hmm. What the radio looked like that they listened to.
Yeah.
I had to really, if you look at every single concrete item, it's whatever the characters interacted with, I needed to verify in some form of research.
A lot of food references, particularly yeah. when Tassa moves to the bigger town to go to school, which I loved reading that. And I wondered how you laid the table.
Well, again, research the food of the era. And that was another part of my research. I will say that there was a great aunt that taught me how to make the arugula. So I was a little directly familiar with that yeah. And that pastry. But yes, she there's a number of Polish food items that again are in various scenes and help create that authenticity of the era.
Hmm. Iris in North Linden, you're on the air. Hi, Iris.
I am totally enjoying this, and I'm looking forward to getting and reading this book as soon as I possibly can. Last week, on the BBC Overnight and on National Public Radio, were two articles about the discovery of a coffee cup that became, the top and the bottom became separated, and in the bottom of the coffee cup was carefully hidden a ring and a necklace. Of course, there's absolutely, positively no way of knowing whose it was, but for 70 years, in the display in the Auschwitz Museum was hidden this great treasure.
Yeah.
And it's absolutely amazing that these things are still being found.
Right. I thought that's a really great observation, Iris. Thanks a lot for that call, because that is how things sort of, it's like an onion.
Absolutely.
There's lots of layers, right?
Yes. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Iris. Still so much to discover because so much was kept secret for so long. And then so many people died.
Yeah,
absolutely. I mean, that is the sort of, if you will, the joy of being the lifelong learner, right? There's constantly things to be discovered and learned about this era.
Linda Cass, why did you decide to write it as a novel rather than a memoir? It sounds like you did write sort of a family memoir for the family, but then you pursued this novel approach.
Well, yeah, years earlier, for my parents' 60th wedding anniversary, I had my sister was urging me, knowing I had all this material, and actually, that really was the trigger for me to get engaged in creative writing and learn about creative writing, because I had this material and I wanted to present it in a way that would be a gift to my parents on their 60th wedding anniversary. So I did produce a document, sort of a private family memoir mm-hmm. that I made copies for the family members. And it was about both of my parents at the parallel times. But then I sort of continued my pursuit of creative writing and fiction writing. It's the story. I didn't witness my mother at that time. I don't have letters. I had facts. I had an outline of some dramatic touch points and activities that happened to her. But I didn't really have her reaction to how she felt about war, how she felt in living and growing up during this era, how she interacted with other relatives or other friends she had. So I didn't really have that part of the story. That's the story. That's the human story. Mm-hmm. I had the facts and the outline, and I really wanted to answer the question, a more universal question of survival. How did anyone survive this kind of experience?
And what do we mean by survival,
yes,
too?
Yes, exactly.
In a lot of cases. What about your dad? What happened with him?
Well, my dad came over at a different time. He was able, right after the Anschluss, okay. He was an only child. He was from Vienna and his parents, and he got over to the United States.
Right away.
In March of, later, April of 1938.
Okay.
And they met in Columbus.
And they met in Columbus here.
Yeah.
As far as your thoughts about what you learned in the process of writing a book like this, what did you learn? What surprised you?
Yeah, that's a great question. I got a better sense of how, in all kinds of crises, what people draw from. And I think that most importantly, I think the memories we keep are the most important. It's the memories that keep people alive. And so when there's loss, I think people have those memories. And I think that that is something that the character Tasa, that's what she did often when faced with very difficult separations or complete losses that happened to her during this experience.
And it often was manifested through music,
yes.
Her memories of music. And when I was watching The Pianist, he did the same thing. And I thought that was really interesting, just imagining, these are incredibly talented people who can hear music in their head mm-hmm. and read it at the same time. And as far as getting the details right, how important was that in the process of telling the story?
Well, for me as a trained journalist,
right.
It was extremely important. So I might have triple and quadruple checked my facts before I was really confident to put them
about
down.
About the most minor
kinds of things.
Yeah, yeah, social thing.
Yeah, just anything on any concrete fact about that era. I really wanted to make sure that it was as correct as it could be. I think that one of the things we were talking about music, though, I had this great experience this weekend that playing the Carpe Diem string quartet. I think you mentioned that mm-hmm. they combined really my words with their music, and I did some brief readings, and they followed it with the music that was in the novel, and it was a really powerful way to express a story. So there was this individual piece that co-founder of Carpe Diem, mm-hmm. Charles Weatherby, had composed. And he composed a one-movement, four-minute piece called Tasa's Song. And it literally, in music, conveyed really the story, at least in my ears.
And how did you talk to him about it before he composed it, or did he read the book and
compose
it?
Oh, he read the book,
of course he read the book, but beyond that?
No, he read the book, and for him, he said, because I interviewed him for a blog I did and how on composition, because I was just intrigued by composition itself, uh-huh. In this way, inspired by a novel. So he just listened. He thought about the character and how it related, how it moved him, and that's really what he did.
Well, Linda Cass, thank you so much for joining us. I really appreciate it.
Thank you, Anne, for having
and
me.
And also, Robin Judd, thanks to you.
Thank you.
Linda Cass's new book is entitled Tasa's Song. Robin Judd, she's an professor of history at Ohio State University. We'll end the show with some more of Tasa's Song, composed by violinist Charles Weatherby and performed by the Carpe Diem String Quartet. Thanks for listening.